From the very beginning, I should tell you that the purpose of these lectures is, first of all, to familiarize you with the basics of condensed matter. And I should caution from the very beginning that for some of you, this material may be either not interesting or very familiar or even boring. But since not everyone who comes here is pretty much familiar with what condensed matter is about, then I have decided during the preparation of my lectures to build the course in such a way that even people who see condensed matter for the first time could have some background in order to take condensed matter core course. So the list of topics you can find on the handouts, and I would like to distribute now the handouts with the plan of the course. So the list of topics that you can see on your handouts is pretty long, but I will try to cover all of them and hopefully I will have enough time. So if you look at the handouts, then you will find out that today I plan to cover only four first topics. Everything else will be covered during next three lectures. So today I will talk about what condensed matter is about. I will introduce you to basic Hamiltonians and to basic approximations that people use dealing with condensed matter problems. Then I will make a quick recap of thermodynamics and basic thermodynamic relations. This is, first of all, per your request, because on your handout that you, on your questionnaire that you answered last week, you asked me, the absolute majority of you asked me to remind you of the basic relations from thermodynamics. Then I will talk about free fermions in a box, because the key degrees of freedom in condensed matter system is are those that are related to electrons, that are fermions. And I will talk very briefly about the thermodynamics of free electron gas. So during today's tutorial, you will look at some other problem that is related to thermodynamics of free electron gas. So if you have any questions, so don't hesitate to ask me, say, Dennis, even if I look at the board, and if you call my name, I will try to answer your questions immediately and to the best of my knowledge. So this material is pretty basic, so I think that I will be able to answer almost any of your questions. Okay, let's start. So first of all, what is condensed matter? Or people use the abbreviations CM. So if they say CMT, this means condensed matter theory. If they say CME, this means condensed matter experiment. So what is condensed matter? So condensed, the definition is pretty simple. Condensed matter deals with properties of many particles, many particles systems. This is the key definition, and it tells us a lot, because almost everything in our nature consists of many particles whose motion obeys quantum mechanics. These are solid bodies, liquids, gases, so polymers, liquid crystals, so two-dimensional electron systems, and so forth. But it is very interesting to know that all the diversities in properties of solid bodies and condensed matter systems can be described by one basic Hamiltonian. Basic Hamiltonian that is non-relativistic and can be written in the following way: minus h squared delta I squared to m small minus sum over alpha h bar squared 2 m alpha, where m large, delta alpha squared, minus j comma alpha. I will talk about the notation shortly. E squared divided by r j minus r alpha plus sum over j not equal to k. Let's call it this way. E squared divided by r j minus r k and plus alpha smaller than beta, z alpha, z beta is squared divided by large r alpha minus large r beta and the distance of the difference of these two vectors. So this is the basic Hamiltonian. What do we see here? So the Hamiltonian is non-relativistic. And of course, if necessary, we can add spin degrees of freedom just in the sum. So here, E and M charge and mass of electrons. Then EZ alpha, comma, M large alpha is the same of nuclei, and in general, we of course imply that small m is much smaller than large m. So we know that many bodies consist of electrons and nuclei. So this Hamiltonian is the basic Hamiltonian that describes all the properties of many body systems. So the first two terms, they are just non-relativistic kinetic part of the Hamiltonian. They describe the motion of electrons at nuclei separately. Then this term describes electron nuclei interaction, minus sign because electron has negative charge and nuclei have positive charge. Then this term described electron-electron interaction, and this term described the interaction between nuclei. That's essentially all. The question arises whether we can solve this Hamiltonian. Of course, one more very important property not to mention is that we have the condition of charge neutrality, meaning that sum over all electrons must be equal to the sum of charges of all nuclei. So this is the condition of charge neutrality. So relativistic effects can be added only when they are necessary. They are responsible for spin orbit interaction, but are typically small. Why? Because the quantum mechanical velocities of motion of nuclei and electrons are typically much smaller than the speed of light. So for the overwhelming, yes? Absolutely, yes. Sorry, absolutely, yeah. So for the overwhelming majority of the problems, non-relativistic Hamiltonian is enough. So we can ask a very good question. Can we solve this problem? Can we diagonalize this Hamiltonian to find the eigenenergies? The answer is, of course, no. No, because the solid bodies and the condensed matter bodies consist of 10 in power 23 particles, while this Hamiltonian can be more or less reliably numerically diagonalized for 10, 20 particles. So in general, and let me write the last thing on this portion of the board. So in general, It's a difficult problem. Difficult problem, solvable for 10-20 particles, not for 10^23. So I will move this board to the top. So the question is what to do. And one should resort to the whole bunch of approximate methods how to tackle this type of Hamiltonians. But before I mention them, I will mention that this Hamiltonian should describe potentially all known phases of matter. And I will briefly enumerate what phases of matter are studied in condensed matter courses. Phases of matter. So solids, then their transitions to liquid and to gaseous states. Solids, liquids, gases. Then metals, insulators with respect to conducting properties. So here you know that the metals conduct electricity, the system of plasma conducts electricity. So, but for condensed matter, the most important things with respect to conducting properties are metals and insulators. Then superconductors. So this is a very hot topic in light of high temperature superconductivity discovered relatively recently. And magnets. So there, the effects of spins are important. So what should we do looking at the Hamiltonian written above in order to understand the properties of those materials? So the first approximation one can think of is the so-called free electrons approximation. Okay. So simplified models. Simplified models. First, free electrons. So this was the simplest model that people considered a long time ago. The point is that one neglects completely the Coulomb interaction between electrons and considers just the kinetic energies of electrons. Interestingly enough, that this free electrons model describes well the properties of some metals. So it is good for alkali metals. These are the simplest metals, and they are well described by the approximation of free electrons. So slightly more complicated approximation is the so-called single electron approximation. So in this approximation, electron-electron interactions, as well as the potential created by nuclei, are incorporated self-consistently. Basically, this is some kind of a self-consistent method in which the electron moves in a periodic potential. And what people did, they looked for the suitable choices of periodic potentials in which electrons move inside the metal. So electron-electron interactions plus ion potential are treated self-consistently. Finally, one considers even more complicated method. One can incorporate self-consistently the ion potential and the electron-electron interactions only for some of the groups of electrons, only for some of the groups of electrons, while keeping interactions between the remaining groups of electrons explicitly in the Hamiltonians. So here, electron-electron interactions treated explicitly. Of course, if electrons are located very close to nuclei, then they partially screen their potential created by nuclei and create the effective potential for the remaining electrons that are free to move along the sample, so-called conduction electrons. So this is what is meant here. So this thing is the simplest, of course, because electrons don't interact, and we always like to consider the system of non-interacting particles. This is slightly more complicated. More complicated, but still tractable. And to consider interactions between electrons, especially in low dimensional systems, is very complicated. But this is what people have to do now when they consider strongly correlated systems. So properties of two-dimensional materials, high-temperature superconductors. So these methods that I used here are the most challenging methods. And this way of approach towards description of solid bodies is the most complicated one. So this is very complicated. So in my lectures, I won't be talking about these approaches. I may mention one model, Hubbard model, towards the very end of my course, but I'm not sure if I have time. I will be dealing with free electrons and with single electron approximation. So during my course, I will basically touch upon these two methods. So, but before I decide talking about the free electrons, I will remind you, Nicole, yes.
Perhaps you said this, but would you mind explaining what you mean by those two are treated self-consistently?
Self-consistently. Basically, one, you choose one electron and assume that it moves in the potential created by all other electrons and nuclei and ions. So, of course, it's an approximation. It's an approximation, but it's like a Hartree-Fock approximation in quantum mechanics. Yes.
And does the idea of a phonon fit in?
Phonons, very, very good, excellent. Of course. One more complication with respect to these three approximate methods is to include the phonons. So, and phonon degrees of freedom, yes, of course. I have even this in my notes, but I decided not to write to save time. Motion of ions. Phonons. So the phonon are very important, but they are more important for higher temperatures. And people liked very much considering the interaction between electrons and phonons when they considered bodies, three-dimensional bodies, at not very low temperatures. So those effects are important to consider the properties of low-temperature superconductors. And the physics of phonons is also very interesting. But nowadays, people are dealing with two-dimensional systems, quite often strongly correlated, at very, very low temperatures. And at very, very low temperatures, the role of phonons is going to be very important. So nowadays, phonons don't play such a big role in the front lines of research as they used to play, say, many years ago. Thank you for the question, of course. So, very good, very good. The next thing I would like to tell you is to make a brief recap of thermodynamics. And this will be just a quick recap, because many of you have seen already the basic notions related to thermodynamics. If we have a many-body system, then the thermodynamic properties, better to say the macroscopic properties that we can measure, are characterized by temperature T, then or entropy, PS that is in thermodynamic relations dual to temperature, and energy. Energy is important when we are considering the closed system that doesn't interact with other systems. In this case, even if there are many particles, then the whole system can be treated as being present in some quantum mechanical state. So if this system doesn't interact with other systems, then energy is the right variable to characterize the whole body. Then, volume, V, or the dual variable pressure, P. Then, so these parameters, these variables are more important for liquids and gases than for solid bodies, though. Then, another very important thermodynamic variable is the chemical potential. That is mu, that is dual to the number of particles. Number of particles, n. So what is the chemical potential physically? The chemical potential is the energy of the energy that the system gains or loses if one particle is added to the system. So typically thermodynamic potentials, if mu is fixed, then n is determined as a function of mu and vice versa. This is what I mean by dual variables. So temperature T describes the interaction of our given system with the thermal reservoir. So if one has a system and it interacts with the environment, then the property of our system are characterized by temperature. So interaction with thermal, or better to say, energy reservoir. While the chemical potential, mu, describes interaction with particle reservoir. With particle reservoir. So these are the basic thermodynamic variables. And thermodynamic potentials are the potentials in which three of all these variables are considered independent, while other three can be calculated as some derivatives. So in order to do the calculations, we must have the way how to do them. And what the most important quantity here is the operator rho equal to E in power minus beta H, H is the Hamiltonian, divided by normalizing factor, the trace of E in power minus beta H. This is the statistical density matrix. Density matrix. This is essentially the basic quantity for statistical mechanics, in which we have the system of particles that obey the laws of quantum mechanics. So trace means the sum, better to say trace of something means the sum over all states with respect to the averages of what stands under the sign of trace. This notation is very important because we sum over all states, not over all energies of the Hamiltonian. So this means that if we have the degenerate levels for our systems, then we must take them into account separately while calculating the trace. Beta is 1 over kBT. And quite often, people measure temperature in the units of energy. So kB is the Boltzmann constant, often simply assumed to be equal to 1, or often set to 1, the Boltzmann constant. So if we have any quantity, then we any quantity A, so it follows that the average of any quantity A is equal to the trace of this quantity with the weight in the form of density matrix. Then entropy can be also expressed as a trace of minus kB. Well, so sometimes I will be setting kB to 1, sometimes I won't be. So minus kB times trace over rho, logarithm of rho. The physical meaning of entropy is that exponent of entropy divided by kB is the number of states available to this system. So at zero temperature, the system is in the ground state. So the entropy is zero. Because at zero temperature, the system quantum mechanically must be in its ground state. So this is the famous Nernst theorem. And this is partially the reason why entropy S is considered a dual variable to temperature T. Now energy. So this is entropy S, then energy. Simply energy, E. That is the average value of the Hamiltonian. Of course, when we calculate the average value of the Hamiltonian, we use this formula. So all averages are calculated with the weight in the form of statistical density matrix. Free energy. F equal to E minus TS. So yeah, here I use the notation in which Boltzmann constant is set to one. It's very convenient. It's very convenient not to worry about the Boltzmann constant and simply assume that temperature and all and energy, they have the same units. Free energy is the most important quantity in statistical physics. Why? Because it is calculated according to the following formula. F equal to minus T log Z, where Z is equal to trace of E minus beta H. So in fact, what stands here is Z. And Z has the following meaning. No, not the meaning, but the following name. It is called partition function. Partition function. This is just the definition. If we have the Hamiltonian, then what people do when they consider the properties of condensed matter system, they calculate the partition function. The basic step is partition function. If partition function is known, then all thermodynamic quantities, all thermodynamic potentials, and its derivatives are also known. So if we know F and F, and F is calculated as a function of T, V, and N. If we know F, then we can calculate entropy as minus dF over dT under constant values of V and N. Then pressure as minus dF over dV for constant T and N, and chemical potential mu as the derivative of F with respect to N for constant T and V. Here we have minus signs, and here we have plus signs. So those relations implies that dF is equal to minus S dT in the differential form, minus PdV plus mu dN. So I decided to write down just one of the most important relations containing the differential of one of the thermodynamic potential, namely free energy. Of course, a very measurable quantity in condensed matter is heat capacity that is calculated given the volume is constant. So the heat capacity for the constant volume is calculated as T times dS over dT for constant volume and the number of particles. So we first calculate, if we know free energy calculated after we calculate partition function, then we first take the first derivative with respect to temperature to find entropy, and then differentiate once again over temperature to find heat capacity. Heat capacity. Okay, any questions at this point? So what I'm telling you regarding thermodynamics, it is of course not a very consistent and rigorous and strict presentation, but hopefully these relations will be seen by you in the future, and the purpose of this presentation is simply possibly refresh your memory regarding thermodynamics. Very good, very, very good. So let me then use this board. And tell you that free energy is used when we have the constant number of particles. But quite often it is more convenient to use another thermodynamic potential in which the number of particles can vary. This potential is called grand canonical potential. Grand canonical potential. And it is denoted by omega, that is a function of T, V, and the chemical potential mu. So it is calculated as minus temperature times log over another function Z supplied with index GR, meaning grand. And Z grand is called the grand partition function. Grand partition function. So its definition is taking the trace over E in power minus beta, but here we have not simply H, but H minus mu times N. So mu is fixed, N can be arbitrary. So this is the definition of the grand partition function. When we know grand partition function, we know the grand canonical potential, and calculate other thermodynamic quantities S minus d omega over dt for constant V and mu. P is minus d omega over dv for fixed t and mu, and n as minus d omega over d mu for constant t and v. This last relation is very important. Yes? So in the grand partition function, we keep T, V, and mu fixed, and mu fixed. Mu should be introduced from the very beginning. So, and in fact, we have the other basic thermodynamic relations that connects the grand canonical potential with the free energy. Omega is equal to F minus mu N. So this is quite natural, because we add mu n with the minus sign to the Hamiltonian from the very beginning doing our calculations. So that's essentially all I wanted to tell you regarding thermodynamics. So if you have any questions, so these formulas are just for your reference. Just for your reference, when you see them in your statistical mechanics course taught later, closer towards Christmas break. So if you see these formulas so that you could quickly recall what they mean. Yes? Maxwell, which Maxwell?
So partial derivative, partial, of course. So for the partial derivative, so this is the notation in which we take the derivative.
No, it's okay. I had a different question I can ask after class.
Okay, just ask after class. So So here in all these formulas, the derivatives with respect to one independent variable are taken under the condition that other independent variables are kept fixed. Well, so sometimes this is customary in textbooks for thermodynamics. Keep explicitly which variables are kept fixed. So, Okay. Let me continue and go to the next topic in my list, the topic of free fermions in a box. Yeah, I should have used blackboards more efficiently, but anyway. So, free fermions in a box. So let's suppose that we have the Schrödinger equation with the Hamiltonian acting on the wave function, and then written the following way: I sigma I h squared delta I squared to m acting on the wave function of many particles, of n particles, each of them having spin sigma, and the coordinates of those particles are labeled by r1, r2, and so forth, rn. And this is equal to E times the same wave function, r1, sigma 1, and so forth. Right. Delta I is the Laplacian acting on the coordinates of I particle. So what is important is that what stands here acts on the degrees of freedom belonging to only one particle. So the problem of many particles reduces to finding the energies of only one particle. So what we need to do, we need to consider the eigenvalues of H1, the Hamiltonians, that acts on the wave function of only one particle. So if we have this equal to minus I squared delta squared divided by 2m psi r sigma equal to epsilon psi r sigma. So since we are having fermions, then from quantum mechanics you probably know that when we know the wave functions of each particles, we can construct the total wave functions for many particles. So, and if we know this psi, then we can write the total wave function in the following way: 1 over n factorial times sigma here minus 1 in power s, and here we have the product of wave functions belonging to 2, all the particles, psi si, ri, sigma I. So what is s? Sum over s means the sum over all permutations. If we have, say, particle 1 in state 1, then particle 2 in state 2, then sum means the sum over permutations. Of particles. This is the consequence of the fact that our electrons are indistinguishable. And their wave function must obey the Pauli exclusion principle, meaning that each state must contain not more than one particle. So either a state has no particles or it contains only one particle. So the wave function, to respect the Pauli exclusion principle, must be necessarily anti-symmetric. So this is what is reflected in this formula. For example, if we have two particles, for two particles we can write that the total wave function is equal to 1 over square root of 2 times psi r1 sigma 1. So that's what we call it. 1 psi r2 so sigma 2 psi 2 minus psi with the index 2. We pre-permute those states r1 sigma 1 psi 1 r2 sigma 2. This is just an example, but what is important is that all we have to know to construct such types of wave function is the wave function and the energy of the corresponding state that is related to only one particle.
So if we have the freely moving particles, then the energies can be easily found. For freely moving particle, momentum is a good quantum number. So all energies are just simply characterized by momentum. We have that for momentum k, energy epsilon k are just given by h squared, k squared divided by 2m. K is a vector because we consider three-dimensional box called momentum. So, and to write down the wave function for the particles in the box, we use the so-called periodic boundary conditions. So if we have the box and the particles are confined to the box, then probably the most natural way will be to consider that the wave functions disappears simply at the boundaries of the box. But in condensed matter, people use another condition. They assume that the wave function is periodic, meaning that the value of the wave function in this point is the same as the value of the wave function in this point. So the value of the wave function in this point is the same as the value of the wave function in this point. So periodic boundary conditions, or they are typically written as PBC, periodic boundary conditions, they imply that the wave function psi characterized by k and sigma at x plus L, if we have the box L by L by L box, comma Y, comma Z is equal to psi K sigma X Y Z. And the same for Y and Z directions. So we can then, having these conditions, write down explicitly how our wave function should look like. Psi k sigma should be equal to 1 over square root of v, this is the normalization factor, times e in power I kr. This is just a plane wave. Yeah, the familiar plane wave. And when you have a particle that obeys the Schrodinger, whose wave function obeys the Schrodinger equation, and it moves in free space, then you also have the same form, exponent in power ikr, right? Only in this case, when we have a particle in a box, k momentum is not, strictly speaking, a continuous variable. Instead, it is discrete. It is discrete, and one can easily check that due to this condition, k is equal to 2 pi divided by L, and it's a vector, 2 pi divided by L times some integers that I call Lx, Ly, and Lz. So Lx, Ly, and Lz are just integers running from minus infinity to infinity. So we, in fact, have the situation in which when we put the particle in a box and have the periodic boundary conditions, we have the situation in which the spectrum is discrete. Is this thing clear? So these conditions are obtained from these conditions. So k's must have the same form. Nevertheless, they are also called momenta. Only contrary to the situation in which the free particles moves from minus infinity to infinity and has the interpretation of a free wave, here we have the wave function with momentum that is discrete. Of course, if L goes to infinity, then our box stretches up to infinity and we recover the full space and k becomes continuous as well. So this thing is very, very important in condensed matter because this is just the starting point. We first start with a free particle moving in a box, obtain this form of the spectrum, and only subsequently, during the process of calculating thermodynamic variables, take the thermodynamic limit. So I will talk shortly about the thermodynamic limit and what it means to take the size of the box tending to infinity. Thermodynamic limit. So this is basically the limit when we take L going to infinity. So volume V equal to L cubed also goes to infinity. What happens? So if we take this limit, then epsilon k, the spectrum, becomes almost continuous. The distance between the neighboring energy levels simply disappears. It tends to zero. So epsilon of k, say, plus 2 pi over L minus epsilon k divided by epsilon k tends to zero. The energy levels in this case become located very close to each other, or as people say, the energy levels become dense. So, and because all thermodynamic quantities are calculated in this limit, we must have the procedure how to calculate them. So if we have some kind of a quantity that depends on momenta, then in the process of calculating thermodynamic quantities, we must sum over energy levels. And since all energy levels are characterized by this momentum k, we must sum over all k. So if fk is a function of momentum, then we must know how to calculate sum over all k's of this function. In the thermodynamic limit. And here we use very useful property. Very useful property. Look, when we have this sum, we can write it as follows. Sum over k of fk, k times, if we look at this formula, times delta lx, delta ly, delta lz. But delta lx, delta ly, and delta lz, these are just the increments in increases of integers. So this is one. But from the other side, we can write from this formula that, so use that delta ki equal to 2 pi l delta li. Use this and insert delta lx, delta ly, and delta lz from this formula into this formula. So use this and insert it in the formula above to get the following. To get the following, v divided by 2 pi cubed, sum over k, fk, delta kx, delta ky, delta kz. And substitute those delta by simply differentials. So instead of deltas, we write dkx, dky, dkz. So this is the infinitesimal element in the k space. I will denote it as d3k. And take, instead of the sum k, the integral. V over 2 pi cubed times f as a function of continuous variable k times d3k. So once again, the basic rule, is sum over k of f k, where k's are given by this formula in the thermodynamic limit, is equal to, is going to v divided by 2 pi cubed integral fk times d3k. This rule you should remember once and forever, because this is the basic rule that people use when they go to thermodynamic limit in calculations in condensed matter. K is a, yes, question, Daniel. Mm-hmm. Hmm? Repeat it again. The same approach to
Planck's derivation of the black body law in dimension space?
Yes, the same approach, yes. Yeah, of the black body law. Yes, so to derive the black body law, you should consider the system of photons. These are bosonic particles with spin zero. Absolutely. Yeah, this is the same approach. And you'll probably see that the same approach when you will be taught introduction to quantum field theory. You will be mentioned, at least. Absolutely, this is the same approach, yes. Any other questions? So this is the basic rule. Down the road, I will mention another rule that concerns the delta function. You know, you saw the delta function in the previous course, right? But you also know such a notion as the Kronecker delta symbol. So whenever you have the discrete set of variables, you can introduce the Kronecker delta symbol. So if two variables are equal from this set, then the value of this Kronecker symbol is equal to one. And if the values are not equal, then it is zero. So one can introduce the Kronecker symbol with respect to the discrete set of states, k and k prime, that obey this formula, right? Because they are discrete. So k, k prime. So the question is, when you take the thermodynamic limit, is there any correspondence between the Kronecker delta function? Well, so sometimes people call it Kronecker delta function, sometimes they call it Kronecker delta symbol, and the Dirac delta function. And the question, the answer to this question is, there is the correspondence. So when we take the limit L going to infinity here, L going to infinity, then we can also, taking the limit L going to infinity, say that this Kronecker delta symbol goes to T P in power 3 divided by volume V times Dirac delta function. Well, it is the delta function with respect to the vector variable that of k minus k prime. So because we have the vector variable k minus k prime, then it's just the product of delta functions with respect to the differences of components, kx minus kx prime, ky minus ky prime, delta kz minus kz prime. This is another useful relation whose derivation is similar. And I will just state this relation. Then one can go further. One can go further if the function f is not simply the function of momentum, but instead the function of energy. So what if f of k is a function of, not simply of k, but as a function of epsilon k? So it's a function of epsilon, and epsilon is itself a further function of k. So in this case, we can do the following. We can, assuming that this function does not depend on spin, we can do the following. We can sum over k, and I will add spin, because when I introduce the notion of the density of states, typically for electrons, density of states also takes into account that there are two possible options for spin, spin up or spin down. So sum over k sigma of this function f of epsilon k can be rewritten according to the above mentioned rule in the following way: 2 from spin, V divided by 2 pi cubed integral d3k f epsilon k. And I will do the following. I will do the following trick: 2V divided by 2 pi cubed d3k times, I will introduce the delta function
in the following way, d epsilon f of epsilon delta epsilon minus epsilon k. Right? Because when you integrate this delta function with respect to epsilon, then instead of epsilon here, you recover epsilon k and recover what stands here. And write it in the following way, v d epsilon d of epsilon f of epsilon. And this thing, d of epsilon equal to 2 divided by 2 pi cubed d3k delta epsilon minus epsilon k is called the density of states. The density of state means that we have certain number of states per the interval in energy. So if we choose some interval in energies, then we can ask a question. How many states are located in this interval? So when we take the thermodynamic limit, we can say that the energy levels are located very densely. And if we simultaneously take the limit of the energy interval going to zero and the limit of the number of states in this interval going into infinity, then we receive the finite number in the thermodynamic limit. So this is the main advantage of introducing this quantity called the density of states. So this is very useful quantity because it allows us to do the calculations faster if we know the density of states of all thermodynamic quantity. It basically saves the additional time in the process of calculation. So as a very good example, one can consider the calculation of the density of states for three-dimensional electron gas, for the electron gas moving in the cubic box whose sizes are taken to infinity. So as an exercise, check. So I don't have to do the calculations, but I invite you to check that in three dimensions, that in 3D box, we have d of epsilon equal to m divided by h bar cubed pi squared times 2m out of epsilon. So what you have to do, you have just to take this dispersion and calculate the integral involving delta function. So I will not be doing the steps. It's just for you to do as an exercise. So very good. Questions? So I officially have 10 more minutes. So, but it will take a little bit longer because I have a little bit because I have too many notes. So, and during the remaining time, I will talk about the thermodynamics of free electron gas. Thermodynamics. Of electron gas. So I will consider the case only of the zero temperature because it is the most interesting one and the most important one. So when we talk about thermodynamics at zero temperature, we mean that at zero temperature, the system must be in its ground state, basically in the lowest quantum mechanical state, right? And we can ask a question. If we have the system of fermions and have the fixed set of energy levels, what will be the ground state? So if we have, say, n fermionic particles and have the energy levels, well, I will draw them schematically, they're all discrete, then what should happen? Each electron contains spin degrees of freedom. So it can have either spin up or spin down. So at each of these energy levels, one can place at most two electrons with different spins. So if we start with the level of lowest energy, then, and we have the system of, say, n electrons, then we first try to occupy the level with the lowest energy. We take electron with spin up and put it here. Take the electron with spin down and put it at the same energy level. Then we take two more particles and put them on the next level with spin up and with spin down. Then take two more particles and put them on the next level. So these are the energy levels, and I draw them in such a way that when we move up, the energy increases. So two electrons with opposite spins at the lowest energy level, two more at the next lowest, two more at the next lowest, and we move up until we exhaust all our particles. So suppose we have the system of, as drawn here, of eight particles, and that's all we have. So the system of eight particles means that they in the ground state occupy the four lowest energy levels. So we can say that these four occupied energy levels comprise the set of full states, while this, the remaining energy levels that remain unoccupied are called empty states. The energy of the highest occupied energy level is called Fermi energy. That's why particles bear the name of Fermi. So they're called fermions, electrons are fermions. This meaning that each energy level can be occupied by at most two fermions with opposite spins. So this is Fermi energy. It is labeled as epsilon with index F. And once we have this scheme, we can ask ourselves, what happens if we have the system of free electrons in a very, very large box, and we take the thermodynamic limit in which the energy levels become continuous? We have K space. We have K space. K goes from minus infinity to infinity and is almost continuous. So for free gas of particle in a box, we have the following. For gas in L by L box in the limit L going to infinity, we have that in the K space, and K is almost a continuous variable, Kx, Ky, Kz, given the spectrum epsilon k equal to h bar square root k square root divided by 2m, the lowest energy is, of course, at k equal to 0. And higher energies correspond to the occupied, to the filled spheres. And we fill those spheres of higher and higher energy, and our spectrum depends on k squared, not on individual components, but on k squared, because we have the spherically symmetric system. So we fill the spheres or better to say, the surfaces of the spheres with higher and higher energies until we reach the sphere corresponding to the absolute value of momentum called KF, Fermi momentum. So the radius of the sphere in the K space corresponding to KF determines the Fermi energy that will be equal to H bar squared times KF squared divided by 2m. This is our Fermi energy. All states corresponding to lower k's and consequently to lower epsilon k's are occupied here. Occupied. All this interior region is corresponds to occupied states. To occupied states. While for epsilon greater than epsilon Fermi, we have empty states. So the ground state of free fermion gas at zero temperature corresponds to the field Fermi sphere. The question is, and what is exactly KF and how it is related to other thermodynamic quantity? We have determined the nature of the ground state, but at this point, we still don't know how KF is expressed, say, through the volume, the number of electrons. And to do this, first of all, any questions at this point? Is this clear how the ground state of fermions is built? Any questions at this point? So what we do here is very much analogous to what you see here in this picture. First, we occupy the states with lowest energy, then with higher energies until we exhaust all our electrons and reach the maximum value of energy called Fermi energy. This is just a schematic representation of this if we have some kind of set of discrete levels. And this picture corresponds to the system of free electrons moving in a very large box. So to establish the connection between Fermi energy and correspondingly the Fermi momentum with the concentration of electrons, we should do the following. We should calculate the grand partition function. So I will skip the details and present only the result. So I will put my lecture notes on the wiki, and you can find a short calculation there in my lecture notes because I managed to write them too long for today. So the grand, if we have four fermions, and the energy levels epsilon L, we have the grand partition, better to say grand canonical potential equal to minus KBT logarithm of the grand partition function. And it is equal to minus KBT times the sum over L of logarithms 1 plus E in power B mu minus epsilon L. So that goes in the thermodynamic limit to the following thing. Minus KBTV times the epsilon, then the density of states times log of 1 plus E in power beta mu minus epsilon, where epsilon is the continuous variable. So if we then differentiate this with respect to mu and use the relation that n is minus d omega over d mu equal to v times d epsilon, d large of epsilon, this is the density of states that is for three-dimensional electron gases given by this formula. D of epsilon times F with the index F of epsilon, where F of epsilon is 1 over E in power beta epsilon minus mu plus 1, the so-called famous Fermi distribution. Fermi distribution. So to obtain this formula, one needs to calculate the grand partition function, then grand canonical thermodynamic potential, then differentiate this potential with respect to mu, and have this relation. This relation. So here, beta is again 1 over KBT. So if we analyze this formula for T equal to 0, then we will get that at T equal to 0, the Fermi distribution is represented by the following step. This is F as a function of epsilon. This is epsilon, and this is the chemical potential mu. That is the same as Fermi energy equal to Fermi energy, at T equal to 0. So at T equal to 0, the chemical potential is the same as Fermi energy. At non-zero temperature, chemical potential is different from Fermi energy, because Fermi energy is can be introduced only when we have ground state at zero temperature. So if you analyze this formula, then look, beta tends to infinity. And when epsilon is smaller than mu, then this exponent turns to 0. And we recover 1, right? Right. So if epsilon is larger than mu, then this exponent becomes exponentially large in the limit t going to 0. And we don't have anything here. This just means that at t equal to 0, there are no excited states. All states are here. All occupied states are here below mu. Below mu. So at higher temperature, we have the smeared Fermi distributions. And when t goes to infinity, we recover from this Fermi distribution the so-called Maxwell distribution for the classical system. So at higher temperature, we have this picture. T greater than 0, while this is for t equal to 0. OK, let's return to the zero temperature case. I will finish soon. Let's return to the zero temperature phase and finally determine what Fermi energy or equivalent to Fermi momentum should be when we have the number of particle n and the volume v. So let's look at this formula and write it in the following form. At t equal to 0, the concentration n small equal to n divided by v equal to the integral over energy that for the case of arbitrary temperature should go from 0 infinity, from 0 to infinity dE times d large of E, this is the density of states, times Fermi distribution. But this Fermi distribution at 0 temperature is just the Fermi step. So we must have the integral from 0 to epsilon F because all what we have times d epsilon times we will take this density of states and substitute it here. M divided by pi squared h cubed to m epsilon d epsilon. And this is equal to 2/3 m pi squared h cubed to m in power 1/2 epsilon 1/2 epsilon f in power 3/2. So 2/3 m pi squared h cubed. So to m, yes. N is the concentration. Concentration of electrons. So we see that our Fermi energy, and of course for the Fermi momentum that is expressed using this formula, is determined solely by the concentration of electrons in our very, very large box. So of course this is natural, because when we take the limit of the size of the box going to infinity, then what matters is the number of particles per unit volume, right? And this is the quantity that determines the Fermi energy in this system. So we have that epsilon F is equal to 1 over 2m times 3 pi squared a bar cubed n in power 2/3. So if we look at the formula right there, then this is nothing else than h bar squared times Fermi momentum squared. So our Kf is equal to 3 pi squared n in power 1/3. And this is the last formula that I would like to write for you during today's lecture. So you're going to have the tutorial when you consider this equation only at finite temperatures. So any questions? Yeah. Yes. I was quite fast towards the end, so that's why I am asking you about whether you have any questions. This calculation is done at 0 temperature. Yes. Yeah, you can solve approximately, of course, this equation for finite temperatures as well. And this is what you are going to do in your tutorial problem. So can I ask you the following question? For how many, only please be honest, there is nothing wrong if you didn't understand that. For how many of you half or more of this material is new, more than a half? For how many of you half or more of what I have just talked about is a completely new material? Tomorrow I will talk about second quantization, and I will talk also about crystal lattices. Thank you.